Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about tabletop nuclear fusion device or a neutron source. And I'm going to have an exercise in this podcast to explain things very simply and clearly. So let's take this apart. What this is, a tabletop neutron or nuclear fusion source. So a tabletop source is a something that you'd pull off the lab shelf, or you'd device you'd unpack, order on eBay, unpack, pretty much like a microwave. A microwave is a tabletop radio frequency food heater, or microwave food frequency heater. So it's a tabletop device. So you would plug it in and it would produce neutrons or nuclear fusion. It's pretty much the same sort of thing. So nuclear fusion is where you can actually slam two nucleuses into each other with sufficient energy that they overcome Coulombic repulsion, because each nucleus, which has protons in it, is positively charged. Two positively charged repel each other, and they repel each other more at very close distances. And you've actually got to get them to go so close to each other that another force overtakes it, which is a strong nuclear force. And so there's photons, which are the carriers of the electromagnetic force, go, but there's another type of particle called gluons. And these particles have a very short range, but if you can get within that short range, a nucleus is captured. Now, what happens in this one is that you have deuterium. Now, deuterium is an isotope of hydrogen. In fact, every hydrogen atom is an isotope, because an isotope refers to a specific number of of neutrons. So in a nucleus, there are a number of protons, and that is the Z, the atomic number. And those protons determine what element it is. And then you have a variable number of neutrons. In fact, you actually need, starting off at the very start, an equal number of neutrons and protons to progress, but as you go up, you have a need for more and more neutrons. So neutrons aren't expensive in terms of electrostatic charge, and so they increase the amount of gluonic interaction. So if you go all the way up to uranium, which has 92 protons and 253 protons and neutrons in there. So that's 8 plus 135 neutrons, which is 142 neutrons versus 92 neutrons. That's 50 more neutrons than protons all up. That's just doing that off the top of my head. That's what I'm trying to also do, is increase my, confidence doing calculations. Just off the top of my head. Okay, so a tabletop device is a device which you can take out, buy on eBay, plug it in basically, and, produce nuclear fusion and neutrons. Now, that's the same reaction that produces nuclear fusion also produces neutrons. So nuclear fusion refers to a process where nuclei are fused, and you start with a lighter nucleus, and we end up with a more energy stable, heavier nucleus. So it goes, in general, as you increase the mass or the number of protons and neutrons, starting from hydrogen, it increases the amount of binding energy per nucleus, per nucleon. So a nucleon or a hadron is a proton or neutron. The amount of energy per nucleon is the critical thing, because the number of nucleons determines the overall mass. So generally a kilogram of iron and a kilogram of lead, a kilogram of mercury, it's the same mass, will have a different number of nucleuses, different number of atoms in each, different densities, not densities, a different amount of nuclei which go together of different weights to make it. But they all, in general, have pretty much almost exactly the same number of nucleons. So the number of neutrons and protons in a kilogram is pretty much fixed no matter what you had there. Now there's something called, it's not fixed, it's called mass defect. That formula goes. So if I give you a kilogram of matter, ordinary matter, you may not be able to tell me the number of nuclei, but you should be able to tell me pretty accurately the number of neutrons and protons. They might be arranged in different sorts. They might be hydrogens, they might be heliums, they might be anything. And sort of the heavier the actual combination is, the heavier the actual, the fewer there are, but they're still together. And that's pretty much a true system for all things. Now, what I want to say is that starting going up to light, to iron 56, nickel 62. Again, I'm just really going to have to check this out. Is the most stable configuration. After that, anything more becomes less stable. It's got a mass defect. So anything beyond iron or nickel 62, you need energy put into it to make it. And so that's something, some process has put energy into uranium to make it. It would want to fall apart, and uranium actually does fall apart. So what puts that energy in the universe? Well, the energy, uranium wasn't there in the Big Bang, so something else has put energy into uranium, and that's the energy of a supernova explosion has actually, the explosion is not as powerful as it could be, because some of the energy of that explosion went into manufacturing uranium. So it, rather than a big bang, it was a slightly smaller bang, but pretty big, and some afterglow of a supernova is there. That's uranium. But we're talking about fusion here, and fusion, I think, for a long while they were trying to work out how suns burnt. What was the power source of suns? And that's what we're doing. Fusion is, it's a tabletop process which is happening in the sun. That's what we're aiming for. And just hold on to you, we're going to get there. But for everyone, I'm just explaining the various things. So fusion, they thought suns are heating up. It could be gravitational, things can heat up when you drop them. So it could be just, they could be hot due to the actual gas falling in. Okay, it's now seems crazy, but that was an idea. But the thing is that if you have gravity pulling something in, it speeds up. So if you say you're a ballerina and you're pirouetting and you're going to increase your energy by a force which actually pulls in your hands inwards, you'll speed up. So there's a problem that the suns and various stars were not speeding up. They were rotating at a fairly comfortable rate. So there's another energy source. And it was proposed in probably 1920, around that time, by Arthur Eddington. I believe it's the same Eddington. It's the Eddington who went to Northern Africa to observe and photograph an eclipse. And he was photographing an eclipse to actually see where any parallax or change in position of stars just on the circumference of the sun. And he was looking, so the general relativity came out in 1915, and he was looking for general relativistic effects in 1920. So it must have been later when he did the proposal. Probably hard to do. But there was an idea. Now back then, fusion was a pretty hard thing to understand because the neutron was only discovered in 1936 or nailed down. People had an idea that there might be a particle there, but it was only officially discovered in 1936. And so this is by Chadwick, a rather sort of really nice, likeable chap. So a lot of these scientists, a lot of the scientists have personality flaws or not. Look, there's some which are just come out absolutely shining. So Boltzmann was a person who had a great personality. I don't know, there's... people have complicated lives. But Chadwick is a thoroughly likeable chap. He's discovered the neutron, and we're going to have a tabletop source of these neutrons and some nuclear fusion. And so in the sun, hydrogen gets fused into helium. Now, to be absolutely ruthlessly correct, 4 protons and 2 electrons get formed into a helium nucleus. So those 4 protons get converted into 2 of them get converted into neutrons, and those neutrons get sailed in to form a helium nuclei. That helium nuclei is more stable, and it's interesting to look at the nuclear potentials and how they stack up against a modern string theory. It's interesting that the early potentials, which didn't make any assumptions, are much more appealing. They're more quantum mechanical in nature. So, what we're going to do, so in our sun, over billions of years, protons hit protons and they stick together, but there's a Coulomb force, and 2 protons are unstable and they'll fly apart. But there is this weak interaction where, at an instance that 2 protons are together, they can form deuterium, that is, a neutron can absorb, so a proton can absorb, convert some of its Coulombic potential energy into an electron and an antineutrino, and can turn into a neutron. And this takes a long, long time. This is a very low odds process, and on Earth we've got no intention of having fusion the way the sun does it, that is making our own deuterium. So the Bottom line is that the sun is basically a deuterium factory, and then it converts its deuterium into energy in a process. So it takes a long, long time to produce deuterium, but when it does so, deuterium undergoes a fairly simple process. The deuterium has a fairly good cross-section for the production of helium-3. That's two protons and a neutron. The neutron's strong enough. And it's quite interesting, there's a lot of helium-3 on the moon. I don't quite know how that goes with helium-3s in the... look, it's beyond me to work out how helium-3 gets to the moon. I'll have a look at that. So helium-3 is an isotope of helium. So every element is an isotope. Okay, because an isotope is just a way of saying I'm talking about elements, but I'm talking about a specific number of neutrons as well. So helium-3. And helium-3 is produced... the proton hits deuterium, forms helium-3. And then this reaction, I've got to really check on it. Two helium-3s hit each other and produce a helium-4 plus two protons spinning off. So the two helium-3s, which are six nucleons, go to a helium-4, which is ultra-stable, lots and lots of energy. So the helium-3 is still not as stable as it could be. There's a lot of nuclear energy which can be released if you add a neutron to helium-3. So what is the process in the tabletop device? So what you do is you've got to get some way of accelerating two deuteriums and slamming them into each other, or deuterium and a tritium. A tritium is a third isotope of hydrogen. It's got a proton and two neutrons. What I'm doing is I'm walking down quiet streets to my blood test. And it's a long walk, mate. You can either ram helium into tritium, compound. Now, tritium is sort of a bit of a dog's breakfast to actually get hold of. It is radioactive. It is a neutron source, so I think it's got a lifetime of 10 years. Don't quote me on that. I've got no books in front of me, no way of referencing. I've got no way of memorising it. That number just popped in my head. The number I see is 10.6 years. That may be wrong. It is probably wrong. And the neutrons are also radioactive. They're unstable by themselves. I can't go up to the Bunnings or local hardware store and say, mate, can you get me a bucket of neutrons? The problem is there's a couple of reasons. One is that the neutrons have no charge, therefore they'll just fall through any container. But the other thing is that they've got a stability. And again, the number coming into my head is 936 seconds, but I think there's a 7 in there. About a quarter of an hour, would that be right? So the neutrons don't survive very long, and what happens is that they say, not hanging around in this universe for too long, and they give off an X-ray and emit an electron, I'm just trying to think, a neutron will emit an electron and a antineutrino and and radiate. And this is the whole thing with neutron bombs, the only thing which protects you against neutron is a large body of water which absorbs the neutrons. Fast neutrons will bounce around, slow down inside your cave or your bunker, and just basically destroy everything. So these people, I think the US rushed and produced these tactical neutron bombs which you can fire up and just irradiate everyone, and then send in your troops
afterwards, and that was a real unthinkable weapon which really tripped the Cold War variously into craziness, and also sort of stopped it. That's sort of the weapon which ended the Cold War. I'm not sure. Well, I must admit, this is a walking podcast. I must look, just looking at weapons, it blows the mind how unethical they are on so many levels. One thing which just ekes me out is why people make landmines where the actual explosive in the landmine doesn't decay or biodegrade in a year or 2 years. You know, why we still have landmines, you know, I suppose they would have been by the US, I'm not sure who put them in Cambodia, but they're still, oh, they must be plastic landmines. These plastic landmines dropped from aircraft. They're plastic and they float up during the monsoon, so you may have cleared an area in Cambodia. The monsoon rains go up, and then you've got a newer landmine sitting in an area that you thought was cleared. All that type of stuff. So our local fish and chips man used to clear up landmines in Cambodia. That being said, we're talking about a tabletop neutron source, the idea is that we're going to accelerate, create massive Coulomb potential, massive charge, which picks up deuterium and slams it in to a target. Now, there's a problem getting tritium, because you buy a bottle of tritium and you lose your investment. If you're not making a bomb out of it, you lose your investment pretty quickly with the tritium. So how are we going to do it? Well, this is linking back to a podcast I did last night, and it's something called a pyroelectric crystal. Now, heaps of things are pyroelectric, but really small pyroelectric things, and so that's when you heat something up, it will, its magnetic dipoles will become sufficiently flexible that will be influenced by their neighbours, and then you'll get a massive alignment of electric dipoles. So if it's cold, it will sort of, the dipoles will oscillate and actually stick pointing in odd directions, but if you heat it up, the dipoles will point all in one direction. So these are these crystals, and I've done a podcast on niobium, tantalum. It's those ones there which have displayed these fantastic properties. So it's a tantalum oxide. There you go. I'm just walking here, and this is your suburban street, and this person is just leaf blowing the pants out of this house over here. Very noisy, isn't it, mate? So you're going to get a lot of noise. I'll switch it off in a moment. So the pyroelectric crystal, as you heat it up, the dipoles become more free to move, and they self-align. Now, lots of things are pyroelectric. Reading up bone and tins are pyroelectric. I mean, how does that work, mate? But crystals, there's heaps of crystals like it, lots of gemstones, like pages of gemstones are pyroelectric. And that is that if you put a capacitor on them and measure the coulombs, so that they have a pyroelectric coefficient. And let's get your mind around this. This is coulombs per meter squared per degree Kelvin increase. So if you increase the temperature by 1 degree, you'll get this as a battery producing charge at one end. And So you might think instantly, oh, why don't we use this as a thermometer? Well, the problem is that there's a better, easier to control effect called the thermoelectric effect, which is the Peltier effect. I've forgotten the other name, the Stahl-Seebeck effect. I can't pronounce it. I've got the word in front of me, but I can't actually pronounce it. A word, visualize the word. Seebeck effect. So these effects, your thermocouples and your Peltier engines, it's a really good temperature effect. You wouldn't necessarily want to use a pyroelectric thing. And indeed, people in the ancient world would hold these gems and see that if you heated them up, they would attract sawdust and things to them. So what we do is we're building a tabletop device which creates a big coulombic potential, which will overwhelm the coulombic potential of your deuterium target. Now, to get deuterium into your deuterium target, it's just a matter of getting hydrogen in there. So you replace a plastic, all the hydrogens in a plastic, with deuteriums, and you've just got a beautiful source of deuterium just sitting there. So you have this deuterated plastic as your target, and you're using this pyroelectric crystal with heating resistors either side of it. It heats it up, and this crystal produces a charge. Now, the charge is not all that much. However, there is another physics effect that you can do, is that the charge builds up on this lightning rod, and you can make a tungsten lightning rod, and so the charge will produce an enormous field strength on a whisker nanometer, or what point. And this is the charge in electric conductor doesn't uniformly go over the entire stuff. It concentrates on the points and tips. So I don't know if you can imagine that. If anyone can remember this bad, awful film called The Hindenburg, that showed sand almost fire, something like that. This is electrical charges growing up. What you have is your pyroelectric crystal, which you buy from a pyroelectrical crystal manufacturer, who is making these pyroelectric crystals for some reason, possibly to sell to universities. And on one end of on the side of the crystal, you strap a few resistors, heat resistors, and on the surface, one of the crystals you put to the ground. On the other end, you put to attach a spike, a very fine spike, a tungsten spike, and you put this in a chamber, and you remove all the air, and you introduce deuterium gas. This is hydrogen gas, but deuterium gas. Imagine what a bottle of that would cost. Deuterium gas. I suppose what you could do is get deuterated water and bubble off the deuterated gas. That way, get an electric source if you want to make it really compact. And what happens is that the deuterium gas floats near the needle point, so there's a huge electric field near that point. And mind me, I find it's hard to understand, but this is an enormous charge, and this creates an electron. So it floats off, and the electric field gradient is such, so a neutral deuterium doesn't feel an electric charge. You can't get an electrostatic pair of tweezers and pick up some deuterium. So deuterium will move to what is basically almost an electrostatic black hole, and there's a tidal force. That's exactly what it is, a tidal force due to the gradient of the electric field is sufficient to ionize it. When it ionizes, the electron's gone, it's no longer bound, and that deuterium then accelerates at a huge rate. I don't know how you can actually, I suppose there is a direction that it would accelerate in. And then slams up against, travels through the chamber and slams up against the deuterium target. The two fuse together, emitting a neutron and producing helium-3. And helium-3 packs a fair amount of punch. The neutron has a fair amount of kinetic energy. What you've done is you've actually done deuterium-deuterium or deuterium-tritium reaction. And so there's many tabletop sources of fusion outside the gaseous fusion happening inside suns. And so this little device, well, it's not so little, but you can imagine it being miniaturized. Now, it's not one, I suppose, low-cost neutron source. So you can produce neutrons. I don't know how many neutrons you produce, but I think it would be in the millions and tens of millions of neutrons that you'd produce out of it. Even that's a very tiny number of neutrons to produce of a particular energy. So there's going to be no threat to a nuclear reactor which produces bulk neutrons, but we're edging towards it, and it's in nowhere near the an energy source of the future. But it could be used in spaceships and space programs if you needed a neutron source up in space. I think it could be quite a nice light neutron source that you could take to another planet. And of course, neutrons are ideal water diviners. That's right. Neutrons, because they don't interact with anything. If you drop a couple of neutrons, they will just fall through the Earth until they hit some water. And when they hit the water, they'll start picking up X-rays. So if you're really desperate for water in a desert, you get out your neutron, tabletop neutron source. They have to be thermal neutrons. But you drop your neutrons down and you use your X-ray detector, and you can detect if there's water down there. Thanks for listening. I'll keep on podcasting. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.